Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone.
Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas.
Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that it takes about 3 or 4 years for a coffee tree to mature and start producing fruit. And once it starts flowering, it'll only produce about a pound of green coffee a year, depending on region and altitude and soil and all that. And it takes between 3,000 and 4,000 coffee beans to create a single bag of delicious coffee. So coffee is actually a pretty rare, special commodity, but you already knew that because you listened to this podcast.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's guest is someone special. Dan Cox has been involved in just about every aspect of the coffee industry for more than 30 years. And he's been on TV countless times talking about consumer trends, pricing, product handling. He's also one of the few people on the planet you can go to for coffee legal matters and is actually part of coffee lawsuits when they need a legal consultant. He's also been a 3-term president of the Specialty Association of America for coffee and the Specialty Coffee Association of America, called a man of the year even. So if you were to basically sum it up in just one sentence, Dan, is it fair to say that you're old school coffee mafia? Is that accurate?
I'm considered old school, certainly. I hang out with a clan of notorious coffee aficionados that really believe this is still a pretty special product and that we're all pretty passionate about it. Since I have 3 companions that we've traveled to 19 different countries together and countless plantations and co-ops. So I still really like what I do. I'm very fortunate. I love what I do. I'm considered at the top of my game, but candidly, I don't believe there is such a thing as an expert. There's always something new to learn. And sometimes I hear these outlandish claims that I go, at first I say, no way. And yet, as I look deeper, there's always possibilities of something new on the horizons and things happening that make this still an incredibly cool occupation to work in.
Coffee's changed enormously over the past 30 or so years. And it's fascinating because you were there since the first Starbucks opened. Essentially, you were involved with coffee from that time frame, right?
Yeah, I was really lucky. In the United States, coffee has been a mature product since really, you know, right after the Revolutionary War. In the early 1900s, turn of the century, every town in the USA had a small coffee roaster. That pretty much ended with the emergence of cans coffee, which had long shelf lives. And number two, the emergence of supermarkets, where people would go into one store to buy baked goods and coffees and the other stuff you can get into a supermarket. And it stayed pretty flat. Our high point in coffee consumption in the United States was 1964, where about 76% of the people drank 3.2 cups of coffee per day. And then it died. It started going backwards because of the emergence of sodas and the great marketing that the soda companies picked up. So, and the coffee industry pretty much stuck with trying to attract existing coffee drinkers to change to their brand instead of enticing new coffee entrants into the industry, which would be the teenagers. Starbucks came along, and they also introduced a species called Robustas to create price wars. So consequently,
wait, Starbucks didn't introduce Robusta. That was
general
coffee industry. Just
okay, yeah, cool. The coffee industry in the late 60s decided to fight the price wars. So you had the Maxwell House, the Crafts, the Folgers, and they knew that people would come into a supermarket to buy a pound of coffee a week. So whatever they put on deal, they didn't feel there was a lot of loyalty in the brands. And so in order to reduce prices, one of the easiest things was to do was to reduce cost of goods. And the number one cost of goods was the Arabica. And so they introduced Robusta beans. And if you do it slowly over time, it won't be nearly as noticeable. And so the rise of great marketing in sodas, the decline of great coffee meant that the industry was going backwards. Around late 70s or early 80s, the emergence of Pete's Coffee Company in the West Coast, a great company based out of Oakland, California, and Berkeley, California. He was really the instigator. And then Starbucks picked up, and Starbucks did a great job of making coffee cool, making it a cool occasion, making it hip. I laugh because Starbucks is probably the number one or two user of milk products in the United States. getting a black cup of coffee at Starbucks is actually kind of hard. People use a lot of additives. And then in my old stomping grounds, I was the first employee at a place called Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, which we started in 1981.
No, that's ginormous. Just so people know, Green Coffee Mountain Roasters is a $1 billion coffee company, right?
It's actually $5 billion.
Yeah, exactly. So number one there. That's phenomenal. So what's the latest what is third wave coffee, and how is Starbucks different than third wave coffee, and what's the Dunkin' Donuts Starbucks thing? So give me a little bit more and give people listening kind of an understanding of like the amazing business of coffee.
Well, the third wave is now being split into two directions. And it's pretty interesting because Starbucks is essentially looking for all of their growth to be overseas, international, and pretty much Asia. They are very Asia-oriented right now.
Are you over there a lot, Dan? Do you see what they're doing in Asia?
I don't go there, but I am very cognizant of what they're doing over there and their plans.
It's nuts. When you walk down any street in a big city, there's more Starbucks there than in New York City, I swear.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, in Asia, a normal city for them can be 4 or 5 million. Over here, 4 or 5 million person city is Chicago. So they have their marketeers are so much greater than ours. So Starbucks feels they've got the United States covered pretty much on two fronts: retail in their own stores and retail in the supermarkets. They'll continue to make some splash, but reality is they're going overseas. Dunkin' Donuts, which is a pretty interesting East Coast consumer, East Coast retailer, they've got about 6,000 stores, of which about 5,200 of them are east of the Mississippi. So most people on the West Coast really don't know too much about Dunkin' Donuts. The other big player, of course, is McDonald's. McDonald's with 31,000 locations, they decided 2 years or 3 years ago to get more serious about coffee. And they've done a pretty good job elevating, mainly through price and a better quality product that a dollar value. Their biggest product is their cafe frozen coffee drink. And boy, that is going really well for them. So they're doing really well.
So the trick to selling a lot of coffee is sell a lot of milk and a lot of sugar.
Well, that's we are a fat, cold, sugar-based society. If I was to say, what are the three big things? We love fat, we love sugar, and we love cold and portion and then distribution. So hence sodas and any product that has a lot of fat in it. The other part, so the third wave now is the small stores, the blue bottles, the four barrels, the people that want to get into making coffee literally dripped by the cup,
right?
Individual. What trend that they're breaking, which is unusual, is we are so convenience-oriented, drive-through, time-oriented, that we live in the era of line speed. The shorter, the better. So in a traditional takeout, drive-through, scenarios, whether it's a Wendy's or a McDonald's, 90 seconds is the goal. From the time you order to the time you drive away, they want to do that in 90 seconds. That's pretty darn quick. A minute and 20 is the next one. So to go into a store like Blue Bottle or Four Barrel, and I love Four Barrel in the Bay Area.
The one in Valencia, the one there?
Yes.
I used to work a block away from there, yeah. And I know Tal, the head roaster there. I've written about Four Barrel too. It's a great roaster and a cool environment too.
It's an amazing. When I was there last spring, and I don't really try to sharpshoot people. And the good news is nobody knows who the hell I am, and that's fine. And so when I go in and I'll talk to their server, whether he's a barista or just somebody handing, and I'll ask them a few questions. And in this case, they were serving three different Kenyan coffees. And I asked him to describe the difference between the three. And this guy was probably in his mid-30s. He was really good at that. So I was impressed that he knew the regions and he knew the differentiations between the Kirinagan from one area. And I said, you know, somebody's doing some pretty good education there. But the other thing is it takes 3 minutes. You place your order,
Yeah. You
go get a seat, they either bring it out to you or you come back. So it's creating the scene of coffee's meant to take time. When you come here, you're going to spend $3 to $5 on a cup and you're going to really enjoy it, but it's going to take time. The exact opposite in the third wave that we see happening in the supermarkets is single cup coffee dominated by the Keurig brand.
Yep.
And this is amazing. None of us saw this coming. So single cup has been around for at least 25 years, but it was so poorly executed when it first entered. We had Senseo, we've had pods, they were a disaster because one, the machines weren't very reliable, and two, the product wasn't very reliable. Keurig comes along, and the first 3 years, they bleed red ink trying to figure out how to make this thing work. They started out in the office coffee industry, switched over to retail, and it's now holds first four of the top 10 selling coffee brewers in the United States are Keurig. And out of the top 10, they hold six positions out of the top 10.
So that's why I wanted to offer a cartridge that could work in a Keurig machine. And oh man, the complexity of doing that, unless you're some billion-dollar company, it is really hard. And we finally did it, but it was, you know, an 18-month undertaking in order to try and make that happen.
People forget that Green Mountain has 70 people in their R&D. They have NASA engineers down in their Massachusetts headquarters, and they are constantly looking at making this better. The old complaint was the coffee never tasted strong enough. And strength in this situation had a relationship to the amount of coffee you could physically get into a cup,
right,
the temperature, the grind, and the time. And so they initially had 9 grams for a 30-second brew cycle. Then they went to 11 grams. Then they changed the cup in the view cup to 15 grams.
That was a good move.
So it was a good move. It's saddled with the fact that environmentally, all of these things are a disaster. And they will fully admit that a pound of coffee in a bag, a one-pound bag, you know, one bag, and you get about 50 to 60 cups out of it. In K-cups, you get about 50 or 60 individual capsules that have to be thrown away. And until recently, were not recyclable. Yeah. And so the industry recognized this is a disaster environmental.
That was one of my problems. The ones that I make are entirely recyclable. And that was part of the 18-month challenge because I just don't want to make more trash than I have to. I don't think it's good for the world, right?
Oh, it's a disaster. It's in here in little old Vermont, and I think there are like three or four places in the United States, Boulder, Colorado, Berkeley, California, Palo Alto, California, and Burlington, Vermont, Portland, Oregon, to a degree. We consider ourselves in the leading edge of environmental concerns, and here we are. I mean, you try to open a landfill in Vermont, good luck. The company realized we got to do something about this. And so they've been struggling with this for years, and they've got one solution, but it's not near there yet.
Is it true that they're going to partner with the Eco Homes people to fill the walls of homes with old cartridges?
Listen, if you could put it in tires, I'd be happy. I don't care. But if you could make home insulation, I think they'd be open to anything we could do. The new capsules are, the new K-Cups are made with PET number 5 plastic. And out of the view, so there's a tearaway feature where you tear the lid and the filter comes off, and then the cup itself can be recycled. But you have to do that also when the coffee has cooled. So if you take it right out of the brewer and you try to do it, there's a good chance it's gonna rip and tear, and you're gonna coffee ground. So you got to wait a minute. And again, going back to our nature, we are not a culture that revels in things that take time.
Right.
We are speed oriented and we're speed food oriented, but it's a whole nother story. And the thing that I find interesting is you used to walk down a supermarket aisle and there'd be a sign that says coffee. And when you got in that coffee aisle, there'd be cans of coffee. Then there'd be canisters or bins of whole bean coffee. And then there are 1 pound bags of coffee. Now you're going down and you're actually seeing boxes of coffee. And within the box of coffee are these single capsules. And you're seeing whole beans. Within 5 years, you will not even see whole bean bulk coffee line priced in any supermarket in the United States. Those are those are dying quickly. 1 pound bags of ground coffee. It used to be just whole bean, but ground coffee is now taking over. And cans are going, by the way. For example, Folgers, about 10 years ago, invested tons of money in their new can. It's a plastic. It looks like a paint can, for Christ's sakes. This is what for $3 million worth of design get you. So people can't wait to empty it out the coffee so they can use it as a paint can. But they made the switch recently and said all of their focus is going to be on single cup performance. And so this is a huge deal, huge deal. Kraft is now getting into it. So most of us never saw this coming. And the other thing about Americans, which I love to disparage our fellow citizens, is that we, first of all, we no matter how much you try to force us, we refuse to learn the metric system.
Yeah.
It's foreign to us. It feels foreign to us. We don't like it.
It's like learning French or something.
It's absolutely something that doesn't belong in the United States, even though it's the language of science and it's worldwide. It doesn't matter to us. So my point is, people have no idea that 454 grams equals a pound of coffee. And thank God, because if they could ever figure out the math on what these capsules cost by the pound, you would say there's no way. But if you say, well, it's only 60 cents a cup. Well, I can afford 60 cents a cup. If I go out to my local retailer, it's going to be between $1 and $3. What a steal. And then when you go, wait a second, how many cups do I get in a pound? My God, that's $40 to $60 a pound. For coffee.
It is, and is more expensive.
And the joke of all of them is the number one product for expense-wise in the market is Starbucks Via soluble coffee in a stick. And from my perspective, it is the best soluble coffee on the market today. And I have tested this well over 50 times. And it's got regular soluble coffee done very well from Colombia primarily, and it's mixed in with some about 15% micro fine ground coffee, which actually gives it some mouthfeel and some fragrance. It costs a buck, and there's 3 grams in it. So if you do the math, real quickly, you go, let me see, 454 divided by 3 is 151. 151 times 1. Are you telling me this stuff costs $151 a pound? And the answer is, you betcha.
How many pounds of coffee does it take, or how many grams of coffee does it take to make 1 gram of solubilized coffee?
It's about a 3-to-1 ratio.
Okay, got it.
About a 3-to-1 ratio. So their cost of goods, as I figured out, all in, depending on what the market is in any given day, they may have maybe, and depending on how much they want to amortize their research, maybe they got $10 of cost of goods into that. And they're selling it for $151. No wonder they advertise the heck out of this.
Of course. So that's a super high margin product. Now there are studies looking at what's in solubilized coffee. And the ones that I'm familiar with that are looking specifically at mold toxins in coffee, given that that's an area where I've spent a lot of time doing research, show that on average, there's twice as many mold toxins in the average instant coffee. Have you looked into that at all?
No, I haven't looked into that statistic. Mycotoxins in the plant world, they're everywhere.
Yeah,
they're absolutely
everywhere. And you can't get rid of them. Right.
You can try to mitigate them if as best as possible. The first thing is to try to identify them, identify the ones that can really do damage. And is it obvious or is it something we have to dig deeper in? But there are some big offenders, and then there are a lot of lesser ones. But the reality is they're everywhere. So the question is, what is their level of toxicity and can we do anything about it? And that's important. So the first thing you'd like to do is eliminate them.
Oh, yeah.
Possible. Now, if you can't eliminate them, how can you best control them? And that starts with a rigorous program of testing. So if we look at something like ochratoxin A, which is a pathogen, and it's formed on the mold, on the fungus of lots of different products, but coffee can be one of them, and especially coffee from Indonesia. Or coffee that's been on the water a long time from where it's produced to where it's consumed. So when we buy coffee from Indonesia, it's on the water at least 6 weeks to 8 weeks. And during that time, it can be in a container that's closed, but depending on, and coffee's hydroscopic, so it can pick up moisture. And with moisture, you get mold. With mold can come ochratoxin. You can't have ochratoxin without mold, but you can have mold without ochratoxin. So you have to test it. And in Europe, it's regulated by the equivalent of the FDA in Europe. In the United States, it's not regulated. And the problem with the ochratoxin is it's in lots of different things besides just coffee, but it's not homogenous.
Right.
And so you have to do more than just test one bag. You have to, and a container has, depending on the size of the container, between 250 and 300 bags per container. So between 38,000 and 42,000 pounds per container, you can have hot spots within that. And most roasters do not want to take the time or the expense to do proper testing. There is some thought that it gets roasted out at the super high temperatures, and the answer is that's not true.
hold on a second. There's always people saying, the heat destroys mold. Doesn't it kill the mold? I mean, I know the answer to this, but tell people, as a 30-year coffee veteran, what's the deal here?
Ochratoxin A is a stable compound,
yes.
Like many things. It's stable, which means unless you get to super high temperatures, and super high temperatures are about 1,000 plus degrees. Anything less than that is just considered, hot.
And that's what Starbucks uses on their dark roast, right, is 1,000 degrees?
Oh, yeah, at least maybe 2,000. To get that charred effect, you can't do it easily. No
offense, Starbucks, we love you.
No, Starbucks, actually the darkest roasted coffee in the United States is Pete's.
Right.
They roast it slightly darker. But the range is traditionally 375 to 450 degrees Fahrenheit. That is the range. And then you got to throw in the time it takes, anywhere between a 15 and 20 minute roast. Then you have to work in what's the moisture content of the coffee as it's coming in, moisture content comes. There's about 4 or 5 variables. But if, as someone said, the average roast temperature of coffee is 400 degrees for 15 minutes for a two bag roast of 350 pounds, I'd say that's a pretty good generality. But at those temperatures, things are created. Acrylamides can be created but they can't be destroyed. So you can't destroy ochratoxin A, furin, or some of the other mycotoxins at this temperature. It can't be done.
So the spores are dead, but the poison left by the mold that made the spores is not dead. Well, it was never alive, but it's still present and still biologically active. Okay.
Yes. And the other issue is because technology allows us to get further and further into the DNA of anything, we can see things that used to be measured in parts per thousand, parts per million, parts per billion. Now we're into parts per trillion. But you do have to put that into the old Paracelsus adage, in that the poison is in the dosage.
Yeah.
And I truly believe in that. And so if I was to look at my food source and say, my God, almost everything I eat has the potential to be toxic, I would go, you're right. So let's just calm down and figure out what we need to test, what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. So when people come up and they figure out what I do and they say, well, God, I drink 10 cups of coffee a day. And I go, well, that's your problem. You're not impressing me because you can consume so much coffee. And is the issue the coffee or is the issue the caffeine? Mm-hmm. The caffeine, again, is another one of these stable compounds. People think the coffee is roasted darker, so it has less caffeine because it's been roasted out. Fundamentally, absolutely not true. Not true. It's a stable compound. It's the same amount than you began with, than you ended with. No difference. Now, espresso is a little bit different only because the throw weight is different. So you have a very, you know, an espresso. The espresso you just drank looked like it was about 2 ounces.
Yep.
So we drink about 1.5 to 2 ounces of espresso, and that could have 80 to 100 milliliters of caffeine, whereas an 8 to 10 ounce drink of regular coffee may have 100 to 150. So because it's so highly concentrated, it has more caffeine just because it uses more coffee.
Right.
But it does not have more caffeine by the pound. It's the same amount. But sometimes people also think because it tastes stronger, it has more caffeine. Caffeine, for the most part, is tasteless and odorless until you get it in its purest form.
Now, you may not know the answer to this, and I don't know the answer to it. I've always noticed that an espresso, I feel it before, like if I chugged an espresso and I chugged a room temperature black coffee or something, I'll feel the espresso speed my mind up faster than the coffee. And I believe it's because the coffee essential oils are still intact and they help to escort the caffeine and some of the other phytochemicals into the brain better. Like that fat plus caffeine has a different effect than just caffeine. Have you seen anything about that? Is that part of
yes.
your? Okay.
No, that's absolutely true. Caffeine is a phenomenal carrier of all sorts of things. And it also gives a lot of people a sense of alertness, a slight sense of energy. And most of the studies I've looked at feel that the number one reason people drink coffee in the morning is for the caffeine. It's not necessarily for the taste of the coffee. So when you see it used in the pharmaceutical industry, specifically medicines like aspirin, it's not because the caffeine they feel is necessarily a great additive. What it is a great carrier, and it gets the other essential ingredients in the medication to you very quickly. Just like the old product DMSO, I don't know if you ever knew what that. It was used in horses for recovery of horses.
Right.
Well, that stuff, you'd rub some of that on your shoulder, and within like 10 seconds, your breath would really smell differently. And researchers said, how can that work so fast? We better look at this because it could be a great carrier for other things. So the pharmaceutical industry, obviously the soda industry, is the number one user of caffeine in the world's pharmaceutical soda industry because it has a slight amount of upliftingness to it and energizing. Certainly in coffee-producing countries now, especially in Brazil, they're using cafe lattes and cafe au lais for children in elementary school because it makes them more alert and they actually are proven to be better testers. Up here, you would think, oh, yeah, this is just a coffee guy trying to sell more coffee.
I posted on Facebook a picture of my son drinking 2 ounces of Bulletproof coffee made with my mold toxin tested beans, plus the grass fed butter and the brain octane oil.
Yeah.
And my kids get it every morning. They get about an ounce or two. And you know what? they feel great. It makes them happy. They're not addicted. They don't go hyper. They're just calm and focused and happy. And I don't think I'm harming them. In fact, I know I'm
not. And I don't think they're getting shorter. They're not turning browner. and they're not hyper running around beating on each other. No, I find that in the studies, and I see studies all the time, that the I think the publicity has turned the corner to where there are more positive attributes to moderation in coffee than negative ones. There's certainly still some negative ones, but the industry is starting to say, hey, wait a second. Everything from colorectal cancer, breast cancer, Alzheimer's, there's some stuff going on here that we need to look at closer. So I'd have no problem. My daughter's an adult now, but when she started drinking coffee when she was around 10, I think, first of all, I think she was slightly influenced by my wife and I.
Yeah.
But secondly, she liked it. She just plain liked it. And she liked the taste of it.
I didn't think I would give my kids coffee until they're older. But when my daughter was one, I said, well, I'll give her black coffee because she was reaching for my cup. And I figured, she'll make a face. And she, I had to fight her to get the cup back.
That's a little unusual.
Yeah, I was surprised. But they've just been like that. So, you know, a couple tablespoons, I think it's fine.
If your child doesn't like it, they're going to tell you real fast. They're just going to push away and say, no way, get it out of my face. If they do like it, usually I'll go back to put some milk in it. And you don't have to go crazy with sugar, but usually the first sip, if it's somewhat diluted with some milk, it certainly should be palatable.
So let's go back to, you said that coffee has some positive things. My own research and experience has shown me that when I look at the list of negative aspects of coffee, and I look at the list of negative aspects of mold toxins that are commonly present in coffee, there's a shocking overlap there. That when I experience coffee that is tested to be extremely low, like you said, there's a part per gazillion measure that I'm sure there's, you know, one of those in any coffee bean, right? Because there's so many parts. But when I drink exceptionally low mycotoxin coffee, I feel different. And I even did a little study with executive function comparing two different coffees and showed that there was a difference in executive function between the two. You mentioned earlier the European standards. So they test using probably not the most accurate test on earth, but they test for ochratoxin A, which is one of the 27 different things that I look at in the upgraded coffee beans. But they test for that and they say, all right, this coffee isn't up to European standards. And what is the current European standard in parts per billion? Do you remember off the top of your head?
It's either 3 or 5 parts.
Okay, cool. My research says it's 5 and it used to be 8, but it does change occasionally. And I don't always get the latest update right away. So 5 parts per billion, very small. Okay, so there's a container load of coffee. They tested it. It didn't make it. Where would it be tested in the coffee supply chain? This is at a broker. Would it be tested before it's shipped from the source country? Like, how does
well,
that happen?
I mean, the best way to test it would be, again, because mold can accumulate and start en route, depending where the coffee's coming from, is you want to test it as it left the port, and you want to test it when it arrives. Importers will only do what they're asked to do, and then they're going to try for the life of it to pass that cost on to the roaster. So if the roaster demands it, the importer has two choices. Okay, I'll test it, but I'm going to charge it for the test. Or no, I don't want to go through the aggravation of testing it. You're not big enough for me to do this and eat it myself. But in theory, you'd want to test it just as it was loaded onto the ship, and then you'd want to test it again, depending on the length of travel on water once it got there. But most roasters, I mean, the most common way of testing ochratoxin is through the use of what's called a fluorimeter, because it can be fluorescence. We have it in our labs. We have the capability of testing this. It truly is a pain in the neck test to do. Oh my God, you have to extract from green coffee. Grinding green coffee is like grinding mustard seeds. All it does is gum up your grinder. So you have to freeze it to begin with. So if you got some liquid nitrogen around, that works really well, but not a whole lot of people have that. So we freeze the coffee, which makes the cell structure brittle, and then we grind it, and then we have to go through at least 6 phases of filtering it till we finally get about 2 or 3 mils of this colorless liquid that we put into a fluorometer, and then 30 seconds later, we get a result. So it's about 65 minutes of prep for a 30-second test. And that can cost anywhere between $150 to $300 to do it. And until you automate it, it's very labor intensive.
Now, that test, when you're doing it, what's the sensitivity of it?
Very sensitive. I think the thing, if you're really going to look at this, you want to go right back to the source. And you want to figure out, how can we create conditions that these things won't, how can we grow this stuff that will lessen the chance of it forming?
You're starting to sound kind of like the bulletproof process there.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's really tricky, but there are niches for everything. I mean, I look at now, 15, 20 years ago, the organic system, the organic supply and food to farmer to table now. So we pay more for organic foods if we can have assuredness that it really is organic. We like buying local now. So where you are, there's a lot of opportunities. But the thing that's really amazed me is, why are our systems so sensitive to gluten all of a sudden? So now we go down a supermarket and there are aisles of gluten-free products. What's going on here?
I think I have a pretty good theory on that one. Gluten cross-reacts with, funny enough, toxic molds. And we changed our soil bacteria about 30 years ago by spraying a potent mutagen on it. So we've been having these Aspergillus, mostly soil microbes that are typically harmless, that have become less harmless, that have also moved into our homes because they live basically anytime there's moisture in the home. They produce immune-stimulating molecules that have the same 8 amino acid sequence that's present in gluten and casein. And I believe that's one of the underlying reasons. It's not the only one, but it's one of the underlying reasons that we're seeing this explosion. And I experienced it myself in Palo Alto. There was a toxic mold growing behind a dishwasher in a place where I was staying. And when I got exposed to that, my relatively minor gluten allergies just exploded. And the same thing happened to my wife. So it's a known thing. It's just one of those complex systems out there. And I'm a canary for toxic mold. And that's why when I drink a cup of coffee, I can tell you if it's got, I've had Cup of Excellence coffee that tasted amazing. It was, blissful and orgasmic. But 20 minutes later, I'm like, yep, there's mold toxins.
There's something in there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just amazed that the industry, led by the big industry leaders, the Kellogg's and the General Foods of the world, General Mills of the world, have realized that this segment of the population is asking for it, so we better pay attention. So my wife is a gluten sensitive, and so consequently, we go to a couple of health food stores, and she goes down that aisle, and now there are gluten-free pizzas.
I have some bad news for you, Dan. Yeah. Have you seen the studies about coffee cross-reacting with gluten?
No.
Yeah, there's actually a immune. It's proven by one lab in one case, but get this, they used cheap instant coffee. And there are a ton of people who don't drink any coffee other than upgraded coffee because they react to it. I'm the same way. But when they drink a coffee that's tested for molds, they aren't getting the gut problems that they're getting from normal coffee. Right. And that can be a trigger for immune sensitivity. So if you're like the celiac or Crohn's side of things, the quality of the coffee you're drinking is a factor.
You betcha.
How you react. So I don't know if your wife has paid attention to whether coffee is triggering any gluten allergies in her or whether it's triggering symptoms of gluten allergies, but it's worth noticing.
Well, she switched years ago to decaf, and she's a diehard two cup a day decaf drinker. And she drinks the best decaf on the market that she can find. And
I need to ship her some of mine if she hasn't tried it. I didn't realize that she was doing that because I mean, what is the best one that you know of? Because I'll tell you, I always get sick when I drink decaf coffee because they use low quality beans because they know they're ruining them anyway. So you found a super high quality one. If anyone on earth would know.
There are, you have to look far and wide to find them. And they're usually small micro roasters that are willing to pay a lot more for coffee. Yeah. I find if you're the big brand, the one that's most common right now that I think does a pretty good job, Nespresso decaf does a really good job.
No kidding, Nespresso. I wouldn't have predicted that.
And it's a subsidiary of Nespresso and of Nestle. And so consequently, they're making a lot of money. So they do a pretty good job sourcing coffee, especially for the
flavor.
Oh yeah, they do. I would say from a capsule standpoint for dark roast, they're the leader in the field, as they should be because of taste alone. So the Verissimo by Starbucks has been less than successful. They're not selling very many of those machines. The Revo from Green Mountain Coffee is kind of dead in the water, not selling very many to make espresso-based beverages. But Nespresso still leads the pack by far.
And you find a consistent, high-quality, high-flavor decaf.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to ship you some of our decaf to try.
Ship it away.
The reason is that I take the original tested beans, and our roasting is in Portland. We ship it over to Vancouver to do Swiss water process and ship it back. So it's a very short ship time because caffeine's also an antifungal agent in the coffee.
Yeah.
So it tends to be, in fact, I'll tell you, it's the only decaf that I don't react to. And
Do you ship it over to the plant in the Swiss water plant?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's only about 6 hours, right? Because Portland to Vancouver and back is easy.
No, I went through that plant in September, and I am very highly positive about the plant. I've been through the plant. I've seen the before and the after. I know the management. It's the real deal. I think they're probably one of the best decaffeinated plants in the world. They do a really nice job.
That is amazingly validating because I don't have the experience to have looked at different plants like that. But they impressed me with just the quality and the whole process. So I wanted to make a decaf that not only tasted good, but also was very low in toxins, because the studies that I've come across where they look at levels of various toxins in decaf, not the ones that come from chemical decaffeination like the solvents, but actually ones from the fungal toxins, they're phenomenally higher, because usually you throw Robusta beans, you throw lower quality beans, because you know you're ruining the beans by decaffeinating them, right?
Well, they, you know, it's the old crap in, crap out.
Yeah.
Same thing with soluble coffee. If you're soluble coffee, for a lot of people, for many roasters, said, well, it's like taking your car to the demolition derby. What's the point? Don't take a good car, take a crappy car. And I said, well, you can't possibly have good tasting coffee if you start with bad beans. So now it's the process. Are there better ways of making decaffeinated coffee over the year? And the answer is yes. And the Swiss water people do it in small batches. And I think there's something to be said for that versus a continuous decaffeination process. And it really starts with the water. And the water that comes out of a decaffeination plant should be drinkable. It should be purified that much through the system that it can be recycled and drinkable. So when I've been to decaf plants in Switzerland, in Germany, in France, in Mexico, in the United States, and in Canada, and that's the first thing I'll say is, I want to see the water that comes out of the last batch, and I want to taste it. And if they won't allow me to do that, I know there's a problem.
Wow. Okay. That's a pretty high standard.
Yeah. They haven't cleaned it enough to be able to use it in the next batch. And it takes time and it takes money to do that. It takes a lot of money to do that, to constantly filter. Active carbon is the answer, but it's a lot of people just don't want to take the time.
It's funny you mentioned active carbon. If I'm in a situation where I'm going to drink coffee that isn't mine, and like probably 90% of the time when I go out there, I can tell like my brain doesn't do the things I'm used to it doing when I do that. And yeah, I'm a delicate flower or whatever, but apparently other people have a slight reduction in mental capacity versus, you know, say like feeling as bad as I would, but they're noticing like they don't have a dip in energy later. But I take the coconut charcoal capsules, which is it's almost identical to the carbon that's in those water filters, although it's a finer particle size. I take those if I know I'm going to be in a situation like a coffee tasting. I'm going down to Costa Rica to work on expanding the number of plantations who can do the pre-harvesting steps the way I'd like them done. And I know I'll be tasting stuff that's not as clean as I want, so I'm going to be popping charcoal all day long to filter it in the stomach.
Yeah. Carbon's a very good catch-all for a lot of good stuff. So it might be thinking, well, I think I'll swallow a briquette a day. And I said, well, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world that can happen to you.
I manufacture it for internal use. It's just worth using it. And if I'm going to be drinking strange coffees, I will do that. And one question, we talked earlier about this European coffee. You test it before it goes onto the boat. You test it when it comes off. So now we're somewhere at a port in Europe and we tested coffee and the coffee's bad. It doesn't meet European standards. What do they do with that coffee?
Well, we don't like to talk about that.
Oops.
And I can't tell you exactly what happens because I don't live in Europe. But if it's written into the contract, and if I was a European roaster, I would write it into the contract. So the first thing the roaster would say is it's rejectable and it's your obligation, importer, to replace it with like coffee without the toxins, obviously. So then the importer has to figure out, what do I do with this? It's never going to be shipped back to the producing country. That's laughable. Yeah. So now they have to sit there and say, okay, it got rejected because the level of whatever the mycotoxin is too high. Now, do I resell it to someone else? Do I retest it? Or do I just dump it? And because, and then there's transportation issues involved. So if they want to try to sell it to another roaster that doesn't have it in their contract, they can do that. That's the first avenue. Try to sell it to somebody who doesn't care about the mycotoxin. If that doesn't work, then they could sell it to other countries that don't have regulations. And in our country, that's called dumping. You're intentionally selling something to us that you know has a problem, whether we have a regulation or not. And that's not really cool. That doesn't fly very well, even if it's sold at a discount. But there are many, many roasters that are, well, I would say, less than ethical. And if they have a chance to pick up something that is a lot less expensive, that's unregulated, they'll do it. It's very simple. They'll just do it.
Is there any possibility that the companies with the coffee that they know has a problem in that country might not notify the buyer in the U.S. about the problem?
Of course they will. Of course they will. Okay. Because it's not regulated, why would I intentionally tell you, oh, by the way, the coffee that you're buying was rejected in Belgium because it had an aquatoxin level too high, when they're saying, well, these people don't care. Why would I even tell them?
Yeah. And if you were at a U.S. company and you had even, say, internal standards, you could buy some higher toxin coffee for less and have some nominally lower toxin, mix them all up to get the average parts per billion down.
I don't think it's being done. I'm obviously not at the large roasters. I don't think that's being done intentionally, but I have no proof. There are a lot of crooks out there, put it that way. But that's why I think dealing with people that are incredibly reputable is the rule of day. But the coffee is incredibly fraudulent. For example, there is more Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee sold every year than is grown. There is more Colombian coffee, 100% Colombian coffee, sold every year than is grown. So people, same thing with Kona coffee. So there are a lot of unscrupulous people. The fish, come on. The fish industry is rife with this right now. You go and you think you're buying Chilean sea bass, good luck. So we are very open to, we're very gullible. And so in this case, you've got to know your retailer. And you've got to ask your retailer to back it up with some, you know, simple requests. We don't want to bust your chops too much, but if you're saying this is this, I need to see your authenticity. Wine, old wine is. Yeah. I just finished reading a book, The Billionaire's Vinegar. It's a fantastic story about how these people paid zillions of dollars for old bottles of Jeffersonian wine that were never tested. And you wouldn't even know, and most people don't even want to open the bottle anyways, but what's the provenance? How can you check on the provenance for some of this stuff? Very difficult. Very, very difficult.
And it turns out you're not just a coffee expert, right? You're a cigar guy and a wine guy as well, and a Harley guy and a Porsche guy. Like the finer things in life, right?
I got to the stage where I was very fortunate that I had the ability to make some choices and how I want to spend my time and who I want to spend my time with. And cigars and coffee, that's a natural. So when the cigar craze of 1990 hit, I was among the first to really get involved in that. And Marvin Schenken at Schenken Communications has done a wonderful job with Cigar Aficionado. And I did a lot of coffee tastings with that magazine. Wine, I started a wine club with two other guys in the late 80s, and I would say I'm a sophomore, but I'm a pretty educated sophomore. I just saw the video SOMM, S-O-M-M, which is one of the best videos on how difficult it is to become a master sommelier. And so I love wines. I'm trying to teach my daughter the difference between really good wine and just average wine. So wine will be a lifelong passion. A little bit of speed, yeah. I when I got divorced, the first thing I did after my divorce was I went out and bought a motorcycle. So, and I had 25 very good years of that, and I still do one trip a year with the guys. And I sold my bike about 10 years ago, and I bought a Porsche. So I moved up and to four wheels, but a bunch of us, I go out with Ben and Jerry are good friends of mine, and a bunch of other business owners, and we do one trip a year. We pick a part of the United States that we haven't been to. We fly out there. We rent bikes. So last year we did the coast of Oregon.
Oh, wow.
Incredibly cool. Started in Portland, went all the way down to the coast to California, turned, came back in Crater Lake area, Bend, end up in Mount Hood. It was just incredible. So, but I think my motorcycle days are coming to one trip a year, 5-6 days on a bike. It's about it for my age now. But the Porsches, you know, I can do this for a long time yet.
When you're on a road trip like that, do you stop in small towns and drink coffee of questionable origin?
We stop and drink coffee, but we try to find single chains. We cool. try to, I have to admit, I go in and within a minute, I can pretty much scope out if these yeah. people know what they're doing or not.
Yeah.
And it is fun. There are a few chains that I, you know, if I have to, I'll stick with. For example, I happen to be a fan of Panera Bread, Caribou Coffee. They both, because I know a lot about where their coffee comes from. They do a pretty good job. Pete's, of course, does a fantastic job. But I'm looking for the four barrel types.
Yeah,
that's my pride and joy, is to find those little places in the middle of nowhere that take it pretty seriously.
The odds of getting a cup of coffee that won't basically knock me out the way a lot of coffee does are higher at those places. And I read a blog post once that said, you know, you walk in the door and count piercings and tattoos, and the more of them you find, the better your odds. Is that accurate?
No, I would say that's a really good tale, but I would not say that that's necessarily an indicator of good coffee. It might be a certain type of cult or craft,
yeah.
But I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory.
And it's fair not to, because it's not always true. It depends on the part of the world, obviously. I do, when I travel a lot, I brew my own. I bring the equipment and I do it because I just got used to feeling a certain way all the time. But I will go into those places and sometimes I'll sample it, but I usually don't drink the whole cup, because unless it feels right, I can tell you if it's going to knock me out. So,
no, I agree with you that many times, especially in foreign countries, it's kind of sad that I will yeah. bring coffee with me to a coffee producing country, because I know they export their best and they don't have the right brewing technology and equipment. And it's kind of sad. It's just kind of sad, but it happens all the time. I just came back yeah. from a little island in the Caribbean called Culebra with my family. And this is a great family vacation. We ship coffee there before we get there. And it's kind of weird, but that's what we do.
I was on Roatan, which is a similar region, yeah. coffee-growing part of the world. And I went on a coffee-buying expedition, not to buy coffee for Bulletproof, but just because I wanted a cup of coffee and I didn't have a grinder. I had my beans, but no way to grind them.
Yeah.
And at the end of a whole day of riding around in a taxi and doing backroom deals, I didn't end up with any coffee that was drinkable. Like, in fact, it had sugar mixed in with it, and yes. it was instant. But I did buy a mortar and pestle, and I ground my own beans on the cruise ship later that night. It was terrible, but the things we do for coffee, right?
No, it's very common to see a new line of to-go coffee brewing and grinding equipment. It's from the AeroPress to these hand grinders. They're everywhere now.
Yeah.
Now, I have to apologize, Dave, but
it's fine.
Okay. I'm gonna sign off by saying thank you very much for this opportunity. Let's keep talking. And it's a joy to be a guest on your program.
Have an awesome day. Thank you. Hi, it's Dave again. Thanks for listening to the 100th episode of the Bulletproof Executive Podcast. And thanks for making it the number one rated show on iTunes. I started this podcast with the same intention that I had when I started the Bulletproof blog itself, which was that I could offer a ton of free information that would help you supercharge your body, upgrade your brain, and live in a state of high performance. It took me about 20 years and $300,000 to learn how to do things that aren't supposed to be possible, and then to use them to be a better entrepreneur, a better husband, a better father. And it's not really fair that I had the opportunity to spend that much money to learn these things. No one told me how to do it, and I thought if I shared the knowledge that I was lucky enough to come across, it might help other people. Since the show began over 2 years ago, I've heard from some of the world's leading experts on topics of mind, body, diet, and most recently, even coffee. And so have you. At the end of each show, I ask each guest a question. What are your top three recommendations for kicking more ass and being bulletproof every single day? In honor of Bulletproof Executive Radio's centennial episode, here are some of the best answers from our top podcast episodes. Thanks again, and please enjoy. And I look forward to seeing you on our 101st episode.
All right. Number one, someone was asking me about this today. I was just on another interview. They're like, so why is eating well important?
Deal with your nutrition. Like, be serious about it.
Diet and nutrition. So following a ketogenic diet has actually been liberating in that it's been able to free up a lot of time for me.
It's because it's necessary for everything that happens after that. Everything that you do with your body, the way that you think, the way that you perform, your health down the road, that the number one factor in that is eating well.
Don't follow somebody else's diet. Follow your own diet and do the work that's required to figure out what that is, even though it does take longer than just following a cookie cutter approach. And you will not be sorry, because you'll have that for the rest of your life.
You've got to sleep. You are not a special flower. When you don't sleep for long periods of time, we know what happens. You will implode.
Downtime is extremely important. And a lot of people get so caught up in their jobs and don't take time. They don't take constructive, what I like to call creative downtime.
So I would say sleep. It would be number one if you want to kick butt, because if you're not sleeping, you're not kicking butt almost certainly.
Try to disconnect from time to time. Take a walk every day.
Everybody needs to have creative downtime, you know, scheduled into their day in one form or another.
Follow your desire, even when everyone else thinks you're crazy.
Number one, you are never better than when you're challenged.
That's one. Number two is expressing gratitude.
And then I would say that I think the key to happiness is staying curious through your entire life.
Surrender to the things that you think that you shouldn't do, or that you think are bad or dirty. I think you do them and see what you learn.
Laugh a lot. Because at the end, you know, it's all funny. It's all very funny. It's all a good, good joke.
You know, drink more coffee, drink wine, and drink scotch.
Relax. Don't worry about it. Life is grand.
Now, the end of the day should be kind of a look back, a review of all the positive things that happened. And so many people kind of obsess about the, you know, what they consider the failures, and that's not very helpful. And so we want to essentially review everything that happens, recapitulate those experiences, and just find the positive, the silver lining in everything that happened during the day.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.